Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today we're going to talk about why you should start a business, especially if you have student loans. But first, remember that you can ask me questions for free if you go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Again, that's studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. I'd love to get your questions. I really get a kick out of it. This week, we have two questions that I wanted to highlight first before we delve into the meat of the episode. The first question today comes from Alex from North Carolina.
Hey, this is Alex. I'm a resident in North Carolina. I was wondering that if someone is on the Repayee program and receiving the interest subsidy, if you wanted to pay extra money every month towards your loan, will that decrease the subsidy that you receive? Or will the subsidy be the same regardless of how much extra you pay on top of what you are required to? Thank you so much.
Great question, Alex. Here's the way the Repayee subsidy works. Basically, what they do is they take your required payment and they calculate a monthly payment at the beginning of the year relative to what you owe. Let's say that your interest accruing every month is $1,000, but your Repayee payment is $500. So we know that that $500 payment gets applied to the $1,000 a month first, and the remaining $500 a month is split up in half. Half of it is $250, so the government pays $250 of that interest that you never even see, and then $250 actually accrues on to your accrued interest balance because your required payment is lower than your actual accruing interest every month. That's how the Repayee subsidy works. If your required payment was $100 a month and your accrued interest was $1,000, then the leftover interest would be $900 and the subsidy would be $450 and the leftover interest that would accrue onto your balance would be $450. That's how the Repayee subsidy works at a high level. There's a big question as to whether or not you can pay more and have that Repayee subsidy not be affected. There's not great math to back this up in terms of actual forensic accounting level data, but the suggestion is that that is basically something that you can do. You can pay extra and have that subsidy not affected. The reason for that is because they calculate what that interest subsidy should be once a year, and they apply that subsidy on a monthly basis, meaning that you can pay extra, and that's not going to impact that subsidy that's automatically applied because they've already calculated it. And it would be way too much work for the loan servicers to go through on a monthly basis and try to figure out like what extra payments that you made and having to reduce that subsidy accordingly. So it really is an opportunity to be on the Repayee program and pay extra if you want to and not have that subsidy impacted. So I can't tell you 1,000% that that's the way it's going to work because each loan servicer sometimes can do things that they shouldn't be doing. It might be an error if they do not apply the subsidy the way they should, but that's generally the way it's supposed to work is that you can pay extra and that subsidy is not impacted. Now we have a second question that was submitted to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail from Stephanie.
Hey, Travis. Thanks so much for your work. It's really changed my perspective on my student loans. My question today is, can I make payments towards PSLF on the standard repayment plan? I know that's not ideal, but I am about halfway through repayment using that PSLF program, and I'm about to get engaged. I don't qualify for Payee because I borrowed before 2007, so I'm estimating that my payments are going to increase dramatically. Can I finish out my repayment using the standard payment plan? Thanks for your help.
Okay, so Stephanie wants to know, hey, I'm getting married and my payment is about to go way high. And I want to figure out, like, can I pay on the standard plan? Is that a qualifying payment plan for PSLF? What a great question. In her case, you know, she's not eligible for pay-as-you-earn. And that's really why I like people to be on PSLF and pay-as-you-earn at the same time, just because that pay plan allows you to get that payment capped out and you don't have to change anything. You can just stay on pay-as-you-earn. Fed Loan will send out a scary notice saying you're not eligible to pay based on your income anymore. You just ignore it. And then you just stick to pay-as-you-earn. And then that standard plan payment just kind of happens automatically. With pay-as-you-earn, you can also file taxes separately, and you can do that without having to change your payment plan. So my guess is that Stephanie's probably on revised pay-as-you-earn. And so the concern Stephanie has is if I stay on revised pay-as-you-earn, then won't my payment go up higher than the standard 10-year plan if I'm married and have to include my spouse's income too? That's going to depend on her individual situation. In a lot of cases, people overestimate the increase in their monthly payment when they get married. It's very common that people overestimate this, and there's ways that you can reduce that payment, even if you did do the repay plan or the IBR plan. You can, with the IBR plan, get your payment capped at the standard 10-year if you have a partial financial hardship when you're starting, which means that your IBR payment is just lower than your standard payment. And then with Repay, you know, a lot of times, like I said, people will kind of overestimate what their Repay payment will be after they get married. So I would want to double check that first before telling somebody to switch to the standard plan. That said, the standard plan is actually something that only qualifies you for PSLF if you have non-consolidated direct loans. The reason for that is because the standard 10-year plan is a specific plan that exists for non-consolidated direct loans. That is a specifically qualifying plan for PSLF. So yes, the answer is yes, that she could sign up for that if she had not consolidated her loans. If she had consolidated her loans, then that could pose some problems. Because if you have consolidated your loans, the only standard repayment plan you're eligible to use is one that, if you owe more than $60,000, will cause you to pay on a 30-year repayment schedule mandatorily. You will not be able to get around that. So that means that the standard repayment plan for consolidated loans actually does not count for PSLF. And what you would want to do is make sure that your payment is capped at the IBR or the pay option in that case, or alternatively, if you don't have a partial financial hardship, then figuring out if it makes sense to stick with Repay, even if that payment is larger than what it would have been under the standard 10-year plan. So this kind of nuance is extremely specific, and it's very niche, and it kind of frankly shows why people end up hiring us for student loan plans, because you think it's easy to do all this by yourself, and maybe for 50% of people it could be, but there's just little things that you miss, and if you do miss them, it costs you at least five figures probably. Thank you so much again for those two listeners that submitted questions. I really encourage you to do that. It's actually really easy. You just visit that link that I mentioned, thestudentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and then you just use your phone, press the record button, just speak into your phone for like 10, 20, 30 seconds asking your question, and we'll feature it live on the air if it's a good one. And now on to the meat of the episode. Why should you start a business? Before you start freaking out at me, because you know starting a business is something that's probably akin to public speaking with somebody's top worries and fears in life. Honestly, starting a business is a little terrifying because when you're an employee, if you work for especially a big corporation, you know that your paycheck's probably not going anywhere. You're going to get paid no matter what. You know, yeah, there's a risk that you could get laid off, but you know you have the money hit your account every other week. And you have health insurance, you have retirement benefits, you know, you have a predictable schedule. And a lot of people really like that. And if you do like that, I'm not saying that that's not an okay thing to do. Okay, I just think that way more of you listening need to be business owners than actually are on track to currently be business owners. And that's why I wanted to have this podcast episode. Because the risk of you being an entrepreneur is way, way lower than you think it is. Here's just an example. When you're competing as an entrepreneur, as a professional, you are competing against other people that have that credential in the sense that I can't go start a dental practice, right? Or I can't go open my own law clinic, or I can't go do my own surgeries. Like I have to go to years of school, get a license, meet any kind of professional requirements and join, maybe even join like different associations or something, maybe do a residency. Like I have to do all this stuff before I can compete with you with that specific service. If you contrast something like that, that has a high barrier to entry, to something that has no barrier to entry, consider restaurants for a moment. There are so many good restaurants, in my opinion, in my city of St. Louis. So many. And yet so many of them go out of business. And why is that? So within probably three blocks of where I live, there's probably, I'm going to guess, 50 restaurants. I mean, it is really, really packed. And you have HelloFresh that just entered the scene. You have Whole Foods is really close to where I live, so they've just come out with a competitor to HelloFresh, and they offer sandwiches and like deli meals prepared for like 10 bucks. And you've got all of these really fine dining kind of establishments. You've got chain restaurants, fast food. There's a Panera Bread. So also there's like Uber Eats that can even deliver things to me if I don't like any one of the 50 or 100 restaurants that's within walking distance of our house. Maybe that's a little uncommon to have so many restaurants so close, obviously, because we live kind of in an urban environment. But that's one reason why about 59% of restaurants fail in the first 3 years, according to Upserve.com. These restaurants that do survive, how profitable are they? Apparently, according to that same article, the average profit margin for a restaurant is like 3 to 5%, but that can range maybe from nothing to 15% more broadly. And how in the world do people open restaurants? Like, why do people still do it? Well, again, there's no barrier to entry. If you have a good concept, if you have a good idea for a menu, and you can, you know, get the financing together to just get a corporate lease going, you know, and a little bit of money to hire staff initially, you can go open a restaurant and give it a shot. Compare that though to a dental practice, for example. According to a lot of the bankers that I talked to, the default rate on a dental practice is around 0.3%. That means 3 in 1,000 dentists that take out a practice loan for a business that they're running actually failed to pay that back. And supposedly, according to those same bankers, 2 of 3 of those 0.3% default on their practice loan because of a substance abuse problem. And all 2 of those people were usually men. So in other words, from a business failure perspective, there's probably a 1 in 1,000 chance that your business will fail. As a dentist versus as a restaurateur, there's probably a 60% chance that your business fails. That means that becoming an entrepreneur is very different based on, you know, you being a professional versus you not being a professional. If a dentist started a restaurant, then there's probably a 60% chance that it fails, right? But if a dentist starts a practice, then there's a very low risk that it fails. For something like, you know, a restaurant that has such low margins, how do you get better profits? You basically have to cut costs ruthlessly. Because if people are just absolutely, I mean, think about this, right? Would you pay $30 for like the best hamburger ever? Like so high quality, so amazing, right? Probably not. The max that you're going to pay for a burger is probably 15 to 20 bucks if it's really, really good. Frankly, maybe you're going to even want to pay less than that because of places like Five Guys, Shake Shack, things like that. Then what you have to do to become more profitable is to cut costs ruthlessly. And how do you cut costs? You know, you can cut costs on things like, you know, how you manage your HR systems, how you source your supplies from vendors, the cost of developing the, you know, the restaurant menus, locating the places to set up your restaurant. So the way that you do that is with economies of scale. And so in a place where margins are really kind of under pressure, you know, you see a lot of these big name brands and chains that have access to economies of scale that have the ability to basically cut costs by negotiating better, by buying, you know, more in bulk, things like that. So when you drive like on the interstate going on a trip and you pull out the exit ramp, are you going to go to the chain place or one of the random local places? Probably the chain place, just because, you know what it is. But for the medical world, it might be a little bit different than that. I really do believe that patients want to go to a doctor who owns the place or a dentist who owns the place. I mean, at the end of the day, like if you knew that this is a corporate dental chain versus, hey, this is Dr. So-and-so's office, you know, most people would, you know, probably trust somebody who's a owner dentist or an owner physician probably more. Now, that's not necessarily the case 100% of the time, and corporate offices and chains have their place in that market, right? But it's just really interesting to me that in a world like restaurants, to be successful, it's almost like have a good concept and ruthlessly cut your costs, and then maybe you'll be successful. Whereas when you buy somebody else's professional practice and you just operate it well, there's a very low chance that you're going to default. So why does that matter in terms of incomes? You know, let's talk about why it matters for incomes first. You know, I'm going to use other examples besides dentists here, but it's an easy example to use. For example, in the dental world, you bring in 28 to 33% of the revenue that you bring in as an associate. So you'll find most contracts have a contract pay structure that's basically 28 to 33% of the revenue that you're collecting. And if you look at the overhead for an owner, overhead means like the amount of your revenue that goes to costs. So overhead's usually like 45 to 60%. So stated in a different way, that means that profit is like 40 to 55% for an owner based off of the revenue they're bringing in. Contrast that to an associate who's making 28 to 33%. So if you compare 40 to 45%, obviously that's a lot better take home of the revenue than 28 to 33%. So that higher pay is the difference of being an owner and having part of your labor basically be profit, operating profit versus just wages that you're earning. So what if I told you that a owner could pay less taxes than an employee? Would you believe me that you could make maybe 50% more money and pay literally less in taxes, not tax rates, less taxes than an employee? Here's how you might be able to do that. Let's presume for a moment that you have a $1 million property that you own, a commercial building, let's say. you're actually allowed to depreciate that over 39 years, according to the IRS. What that means is the IRS assumes that you have to replace that corporate building at some point. So if you have a $1 million building, that's going to give you a write-off of about $25,000 per year off of your income. So let's say that you're a dentist making $300,000, or how about a physician making $300,000 a year, and you own your own building, and so you're paying the mortgage on that building. You get a $25,000 write-off on your $300,000 income, so that now you make $275,000 on your taxable income instead of $300,000. So that's going to save you at a 50% tax bracket, you know, about $12,000 or $13,000 in taxes. That's quite a bit. On top of that, you're going to have a mortgage on that building. So let's assume that you have a 5% 30-year mortgage on that $1 million building that you own. The interest write-off would be about $50,000 per year of interest that you could also write off of your income. So if you take that $50,000 and subtract from your $275,000, now you're down to $225,000 of income instead of $300,000. So that's really quite a big write-off already. Now, there's other write-offs on top of that. You can write off equipment, for example. If you buy an expensive machine, you can write that off. You can, some aggressive CPAs even try to have people deduct car leases, which, you know, is a little bit aggressive maybe, but there's all kinds of write-offs that you can do, like writing off CE credits, writing off different kinds of professional services provided to you that you can legally do, and that could save you 50% or more of your income in taxes. While you're writing this off for taxes, you're also growing your wealth by paying down these things like the commercial building loan. You're paying down your practice loan, right? You're doing things that are causing you to grow your wealth even though you're paying less tax. If you really wanted to stash money away, and this goes for lawyers, veterinarians, physicians, dentists, anybody that has, you know, a private practice environment, you could open up a 401k for your office. You know, a lot of people kind of are cheap and they don't open up a 401k because they have to pay like an administration fee and they have to pay a little bit of matching contributions to employees that work for you. And that would be a big mistake to do that. So what you can do is basically say a maximum 401k contribution is $19,000 per year for an employee. On top of that, you can make a match over and above that. So you can put in $19,000 plus you can put in, let's say, maybe a match of say $5,000 or something along those lines, right? So you could put in almost $24,000, $25,000 as an owner dentist, whereas if you're an employee, you can maybe put in $19,000, but that's only if your office offers a 401k plan. As an owner, you can also add your spouse to the payroll in some cases, and you can put away as much as $19,000 plus the match for the spouse. So you could even put away as much as $50,000 and have that reduce your taxable income. So instead of making $225,000 from that prior example, now you're down to making $175,000 for taxable purposes. Now, what if you want to put away even more money? Believe it or not, there is something called self-funded pension plans. You can actually put away about $100,000 per year. This is rough numbers in your 30s and 40s. You can put away as much as $200,000 in your 50s and even $300,000 in your 60s. Now, there's expenses to manage this plan. In general, you have to pay a few thousand dollars per year of management fees to kind of take care of this plan because it's a little complicated. But the reward is that you could put away literally a six-figure amount on top of your 401k that's shielded from taxes, and you can even roll that over to an IRA when you're ready to spend it. So that's the advantage of working with, you know, a fiduciary financial planner that really understands this stuff, is you could potentially be putting away a six-figure amount of money sheltered from taxes going for your retirement, where, you know, you wouldn't be able to do that otherwise. So why have I talked a little bit about dentists? Well, man, we're going to talk a lot more about other professions as well. But really, there could be a lot of scenarios here where you could be making $600,000 a year even as an owner. And if you have a lot of write-offs available to you and you're really smart with tax planning, you might actually even be able to make less taxable income than an associate making $200,000 a year. And what is the risk? Well, we kind of showed you earlier that the risk is a lot lower than for other entrepreneurs because of the fact that you have to have your professional education to open your own business, to open your own practice. Now, physicians open private practices less than dentists, and there's a reason for this. There's higher liability in medicine. There's more malpractice, you know, expenses, for example. The culture of medicine is a little bit more you want to maybe not have be this profession of private practices. It's a little bit more corporate medicine now. It's sort of moving that direction. But those who do open private practices as physicians or join one often have very large incomes. Just as an example of this, surgery centers can be really profitable. A lot of times physicians will own part ownership in surgery centers. Some of the clients that we've had actually have been making over $1 million a year in total earnings because they own interests in surgery centers and they get percentage of production from those centers and they're taking huge write-offs. They are writing off interest, they're writing off depreciation, they're getting their taxable incomes quite low. And you know, you're really getting an amazing ROI for your time when you're making that kind of a level of income. And I'll say this, I think physicians by and large are more risk-averse group than some other people. I think that a lot of people as physicians also kind of value PSLF almost to a, not an irrational level, but people really value PSLF and loan forgiveness options. And that really shouldn't be the case. You know, I rarely see a case where physicians have incomes over $200,000, but they shouldn't do a private practice if their primary concern is finances. If you look at the numbers, usually somebody can easily make more money in a private practice than what the per year value of PSLF ends up being. Just think about it. You know, if you go work for a hospital somewhere, so for example, my own wife's specialty, pay is kind of in the 200 range in academic medicine. But if you go out and do a private practice, you can make, you know, $400,000 or $500,000, something like that. And so obviously, even if you had a lot of student loans, even if you're just going to go be an attending somewhere for like 3 years to get PSLF, that would not be worth it. You would want to go and do a private practice instead if that was your main goal, is to make a lot of money. How about lawyers? What about lawyers? So the same kind of math holds true that as an associate, you're going to make less. And for physicians or dentists, the business development piece doesn't really need to be like, it's not as, probably not as difficult as it might be for a lawyer, because you don't necessarily have an obvious need for a lawyer until something bad happens, right? So, you know, you have that family dispute, you have that business dispute, you're getting sued, then you maybe turn to the lawyer, you know, whereas somebody might be conditioned to go to the dentist every 6 months or something like that, right? So is it harder to start a private practice as an attorney? Perhaps, but if you're really good at developing business, then that's an extremely valuable activity. And if you're good at that, then you're probably much better off being an owner rather than being an employee. Several of the people, some of the lawyers that we've had as clients that have been making six figures, most of them have been actual private practice lawyers instead of people that are associates. Now, you know, in big law, it's somewhat easy to make a six-figure income in big law, but there's only, you know, 20% of the profession or so that's in big law making that big giant payday, whereas most attorneys are in some, you know, small to middle-sized practice somewhere. Maybe they're doing family law making $80,000 a year, or they're doing public interest law and they're making a lot less money. So as a lawyer, the key, I think, would be to find a niche. I never know how to say it. Whatever you want to go by, but find a niche. For example, a lawyer that takes everything is probably not going to be able to charge a premium price. You're going to have to accept anything that somebody wants to give you, and your hourly rate's just going to be kind of almost arbitrarily set, probably at a low level, so that you can encourage people to sign up for all of the different things that you can do. If you want to make a high income, though, you need to specialize. So, for example, you know, we have attorneys that we've worked with, and they are IP attorneys or they're patent attorneys, right? Those people charge a lot of money. And the thing is they can command it too, because I would much rather pay a lot of money for a lawyer that really knows what they're doing versus pay a smaller amount of money to a lawyer that really has no clue what they're doing, because bad advice is way more expensive than good advice, even if the price is really low for the bad advice, because oftentimes the bad advice will cost you a lot more money than the cost that you paid. So that's a great thing to think about also in terms of when it comes to getting financial help or student loan help or whatever. In some ways, you get what you pay for when you're paying for somebody who's a specialist. So if you want to be a private practice lawyer, then I would just suggest getting a niche, focusing down on that niche, finding the pain point for whatever area of law that you want to practice, and then really maybe price yourself a little bit too low just to get clients in the door so you can build up that credibility and build up that reputation. And then once you have the reputation, then you can charge more money. That's kind of like what we did with Student Loan Planner back in the day. You know, when we didn't have a big name, basically we were charging a lot less. And once people realized that we were, I like to think, the best in the business at this, now we charge a premium price for that because we give really good advice. And, you know, when a premium price is only, you know, an extra $100 or something, then that's kind of a no-brainer to go with the premium option instead of the, you know, cheaper option. It's not nearly as good, right? So what about veterinarians? For veterinarians, you have big corporate competition, and the veterinary market is becoming more and more concentrated. So, you know, this Mars Corporation is buying up all these different groups, VCA, Banfield, all these different places, I think. And, you know, you have to compete against these private equity-backed kind of places in some situations that are willing to pay huge multiples for any veterinary practice that's doing over a certain amount in revenue. So, for example, in the veterinary field, if you have a veterinary practice that's over $1 million in revenue, a big corporation is going to want to come in. They're going to want to pay a huge multiple for that. Multiple meaning that instead of paying 100% of revenue or like 2x sales, like maybe they'll pay way more than that even. And so then they'll pay a number that just, you know, a solo veterinarian is never going to get a loan from a bank for that amount of debt to buy the practice. It's just not going to happen. What are these private equity backed kind of groups like veterinary medicine? It's because they think that veterinarians are not very good at business and they don't think about money very much, which is probably true. And so if you take veterinarians and you basically give them solid salaries, but not anything to call home about, and you run the veterinary practice as a hardcore business, and you just, you know, create all these different systems in place to try to scale up and charge people certain rates for procedures and, you know, that kind of stuff, that can be super profitable. And also, when corporate groups are paying huge valuations for these big hospitals, I mean, that's also a really big opportunity, because what that means is those investors are going to want a big return, right? And so as a veterinarian, you can buy a practice that is smaller than that $1 million a year in revenue, and then you can get a way to compete against these big corporate groups, because those big corporate groups are going to have a very systematized approach, very profit-focused approach. Whereas if you buy a smaller practice, the corporation might look at a $300,000 or $400,000 revenue veterinary practice and just say, that's just not interesting to us. We're just not going to even bid, which means that the value of that practice could be a lot less than what it would be if it was a very large practice. So that's kind of really pretty interesting, I think. So if you wanted to be a veterinary practice owner, then you might want to just focus on targeting a veterinary practice for acquisition that is smaller than something that you might draw the attention of a big corporation for if you ended up trying to compete with them. So what are some things that business owners in general should know when you have student loans? It's somewhat obvious that if you can make more money, have more control over your life, pay less in taxes and pay less in student loans, and become wealthier over time with a fairly minimal level of stress, that's why I think it makes sense for most people to try to become business owners in their field. Now, a lot of people say, I want to go turn the lights off. I want to go home at night. I don't want to think about business. Well, I understand that, but I unfortunately have news for you. I don't really think I've met very dedicated professionals really in most fields that truly go home and turn the lights off. For example, a lot of the people that I know that are professionals in my life, they work their tails off. They work evenings, they work weekends sometimes, and they might make a lot of money, but they're basically doing all this work that really they're not getting paid for. If you think about it, have you ever been asked to go to some sort of like health fair by your employer to represent your employer, and they're not actually giving you any extra pay for that, and they're just saying, oh, we'll take it into account for bonus at the end of the year? You know, that's kind of what I'm talking about. When you are a business owner, everything you do, you get to decide whether or not you want to do it. That is a really valuable asset to have. In addition to that, you also are able to take advantage of the student loan rules if you have a lot of student loan debt. So here's why. If you're an associate or you're an employee making a certain amount of money, you're going to have to pay 10% of that under pay and repay. But if you become a business owner, then you can pay 10% of your new income, which if you take over a business could be super, super low. For example, if you take over a business that has a lot of write-offs, then your income might actually drop a lot. And so your payment under pay-as-you-earn and revised pay-as-you-earn would actually go down if you recertify that with your loan servicer. So imagine a scenario where you become a business owner and your repay subsidy that you get because your required payment is a lot lower because you bought a business that gave you a temporarily lower income. Imagine if that subsidy goes up. That's one reason why we tend to suggest that people that want to be business owners focus on doing revised pay-as-you-earn if their goal is to get to zero debt, because you buy the business and then you look at doing a refinancing once you're secure in your job. Pay-as-you-earn works similarly. If you can lower your payments long-term as a business owner, then you could potentially cut your payment and cut the cost of loan forgiveness substantially, even while growing your wealth even more than that. So a highly paid owner is likely going to have a lower hit on their student loan payments, because when you have a write-off, that's income that's not showing up on your adjusted gross income, and that's income that allows you to, you're still growing your wealth with it, but it's just money you're not paying taxes on. So in that earlier example of the physician with $300,000 of income, we got their taxable income all the way down to, like, I think it was $175,000. So that's $125,000 of income that you're legally shielding from taxes. And that $125,000 of income, you're basically saving 10% of that. That would have been your student loan payment. So 10% of $125,000 is $12,500. It's about $1,000 a month. So $1,000 a month in savings in your student loan payments because you became a business owner, that's really, really valuable. Now, another real benefit of being a business owner besides the money part is the lifestyle part. So there's different reasons to run a business. You know, one reason is for monetary reasons, but there's the other big reason to run a business is for lifestyle reasons. And let me give you an example. I recently went down to watch the homecoming game for my school, University of Florida. I watched the Gators take on the Auburn Tigers and they won. And I'm going to be real honest, real vulnerable to y'all right now. So one of the reasons I sound like a frog and I got a little bit of a cold is because I screamed my brains out for like 3 or 4 hours trying to cheer the Gators to victory. So I apologize if any of you are Auburn fans or, you know, on a cheer for a college football team that you hate Florida or something, but that's kind of what I did. And the only reason I was able to do that is because I had a business that gave me a flexible work schedule. Now, could I have taken time off? Well, sure, but I'm the one that gets to decide when my vacation is, not somebody else. Do I make no money for that day that I took off? Well, kind of, but I also have people that work for me that do consults and do articles and, you know, people that are applying for refinancing deals while I'm gone on vacation. That's the benefit of having a business. And I describe that a little bit in monetary terms, but also lifestyle terms. So the reason I'm saying that is because if you want to take a lot of vacation, you can do that as a business owner. You don't have to go ask for permission. If you want to go down to 60% FTE as a hospital employee, then you got to get approvals from a whole bunch of different people, and they might even not want to say yes. There's also opportunities too to buy practices and design your lifestyle around minimal work for maximal earnings. For example, remember I said that veterinary practices, nobody wants the really small revenue practices because it just doesn't seem like something that can, you know, be successful with their model of making lots of revenue, lowering costs, doing it again. And so what that means is there's all these $200,000-$400,000 revenue businesses out there in, you know, the various fields like dental, veterinary, you know, medicine that nobody wants because they're 2 or 3 day a week practices. Now, what you could do is you could buy a couple of those and basically create a full-time practice out of a couple of those different places at lower valuations. Alternatively, you could just buy one of those. So imagine this, as an associate, making $150,000 working 3 days a week would be pretty impressive. But as a business owner, it's actually not that shocking to do that because you could buy one of these $300,000 or $400,000 revenue practices, maybe pay a lot less for them because there's a lot fewer bidders of the people that want the huge businesses that, you know, would compete with you. And then that means that you could work, you know, like I said, 2 or 3 days a week. If you could have overhead in the 50 to 60% range, then you could be taking home like $150,000. So that is really neat that you could spend more time with your kids as a business owner than as an associate or as an employee because you have more control. That's the really the crux of being a business owner is the good and the bad news is you have more control. So if you think that you believe in yourself, then I don't understand why you wouldn't try to become a business owner. If you really do feel a lot of stress from the idea of being one, then maybe you could look into being a partner with someone. Maybe you could go into business with someone instead of just by yourself. That's a much better option than being an employee. And remember, anything that you don't enjoy doing, you can hire. Whenever I have a big problem in my business, I try to hire for it if I don't enjoy doing it. Right now, we're going through hiring a couple people for our content production team, and we have a big hole to fill. And I'm probably going to have to get in the weeds and probably going to have to go publish some blog posts for a couple weeks. But that's not the end of the world. And that is something that if I really wanted to pay enough money to get somebody to do that, I could, right? It's just, I'm probably not wanting to pay $1 billion an hour for somebody to go publish posts while we're trying to find somebody good. So as a business owner, you're going to pay less on your student loans if you're going for forgiveness. You're going to have more flexibility in your life, and you're also probably going to be a lot wealthier. And at some point, you'll be able to sell an asset, which is your business. At some point, you'll be able to sell that business for hopefully a positive return that will give you an additional kind of infusion of cash that you can use to retire on or to do something else with. A lot of people don't realize this, but that's what happens is when you buy a practice or start a practice and you grow the equity in your business, you pay down any debt that the business has. Over time, you own that business 100%. That's the same thing as owning a house free and clear 100%. A lot of people don't think like that, though. They just think about being an employee and they think about putting away 10 to 15% mutual funds and that's it. And if you do that, life will be okay, but you'll be retiring probably in your 60s and you probably will have to deal with a lot of baloney and probably not get the hours off that you want and probably not have the flexibility that you want unless you have an amazing owner. And then even in that case, you're dependent upon that owner instead of dependent upon yourself. I always think that you should bet on yourself. Okay, especially when you're a professional, you have really good credentials, you have a really good education, you have a very high barrier to entry, and not a lot of people can compete with you. And the student loans that you're so worried about are actually not an obstacle at all because you can recalculate your payment when you buy a business to a very low number. The only catch is, as a business owner, you should just know that if you do refinance, a lot of times you need 1 year worth of tax returns, sometimes 2 years of tax returns to prove that income so that you're actually going to get qualified for a bank loan. So that's just the only kind of caveat to be aware of. Becoming a business owner is a great decision. If you are kind of up in the air about it, then just try to get more savings, get more money in the bank, get like $50,000 in the bank or $20,000 in the bank, something where you could live off of that alone for like 6 months to a year. Most business owners I know, their businesses are terrible in like year one and two. And then year three, they start bringing it together. And then year four and five, they really start having a really successful operation in most cases. Okay, so you really need to stress less about the idea of being an entrepreneur and realize that you're far more capable than you ever dreamed of. That's one of the things that we do in the consult sometimes is help people that are thinking about taking that next step, making sure their student loans and their finances are in place. So if that's you, studentloanplanner.com/help. Again, send us questions if you have any. We'd love to hear them. You can check out the podcast show notes today by going to studentloanplanner.com/46, number of today's episode. You take care and have a wonderful day and take some risks, y'all.